Hey, folks, This Week in Law is up next. We've got Joe Mullen, Steve Nipper, and Evan Brown on the show today. We're going to talk about craziness out of Illinois with Judge Posner issuing some interesting rulings in a patent case. We're going to talk about lots of patent issues, including Joe is going to give us the blow-by-blow from some trials he attended, some big ones, the Eolus case in Texas and Oracle versus Google in California. We're going to talk about some social media issues, too, next up on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 166, recorded June 15, 2012. What the Friend? Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial plus double storage, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter the promo code TWiL. Hi there, you've tuned in for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and oh my goodness, I'm not sure what's been going on this week, but it's as though the courts and the litigants out there have been working together to give us a really interesting show. And we've got a great panel to talk about what's going on. Joe Mullen, who is an associate writer with Ars Technica, a front row spectator of and coverer of the Oracle versus Google trial, and a reporter for the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley is joining us. Hello, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you again. Joe and I connected up at the Tech Policy Summit in Napa a couple of weeks ago. So I hauled him bodily onto the show this week. We're really happy to have him. Also coming back to the show, joining us once again, is Steve Nipper, patent lawyer, from the Invent blog and from his firm, Buchanan Nipper, in Idaho and Ohio. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you back. And joining us once again is Evan Brown from Hinshaw and Culberson in Chicago, Illinois, home of a lot of shenanigans this week. Hello, Evan.
That's right. Yeah, shenanigans other than the ones I'm up to. So, you know, it's afternoon here. It's morning where you are. So best I can do is say hello. It's good to be here.
Great to see you. Are you sure you haven't been behind all the mayhem in some oblique way?
Well, usually Judge Posner listens to everything I say. So, yeah. You know, I can neither confirm nor deny if he's deviated from his usual path here. So, yeah, plenty of stuff that could be called into question, I guess.
We're going to get to that in just a second. Before we do, I want to just give an update on something that we've been working on for a long time here at This Week in Law. We know we have lawyer listeners out there, and we know that we get together each week to talk about current developments in technology law. And we've always known that that would be a great way for people to get continuing legal education credit in the jurisdictions where they reside. Although there's a lot of red tape and bookkeeping that goes along with that. So we've sort of put it on the back burner. We have a fabulous intern this summer, Franklin Graves, who we asked to look into all of this for us. And it turns out that if you would like to receive MCLE credit in your jurisdiction for This Week in Law, you can go ahead and right now do so. And we're going to, in some jurisdictions, you have to be able to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. So we're going to start dropping some little catchphrases into the show, and I'll let you know what they are and when I say them. And that's something that you can put on the form you submit to show that you actually, you know, tuned in and watched. But each jurisdiction, not all of them require CLE, but if they do in yours, we've got the form there and the fee that may be involved. You just fill out a form and submit it. And there might at this juncture be a fee for you, but we're working on alleviating that too. We're going to go ahead and get ourselves accredited as an MCLE provider in as many jurisdictions as we can. And I'm pretty sure that that will get rid of the fees involved for anybody who is listening or watching. For all of us who are lawyers, we know that continuing legal education is usually a very expensive process. Even if you're just doing a short self-study assessment, someone nicks you for $30 or $40 somewhere. And if you go to a course or a program, you know, those things are usually hundreds of dollars. So we're going to try and offer you very frequent and very free MCLE as soon as we can. But in the meantime, if you want to apply for self-study or whatever kind of credit may be available in your jurisdiction, look at the forums that we've aggregated for you there on the TWIL Wiki, and have at it. You know, we really appreciate everyone tuning in. We've wanted to do this for a long time for our lawyer listeners to help make things easy for them. So let us know how that's working for you. You can email me, Denise at twit.tv or Evan at twit.tv. If you have any questions at all or you're finding any problems, we're trying to work through the kinks of this. And we'd love to get feedback from you if you're going to go ahead and get yourself self-study MCLE for this show.
Hey, are you gonna drop any of those little clues in the show today, like the little codes or whatever?
I am indeed, yep. And I will.
Is there
something
we're supposed to do, like as other panelists on the show? Are we supposed to throw confetti or say something in response or anything like that?
Sure, you know, wad up some newspaper and throw it at your camera.
It's just like Pee Wee's Playhouse. If you say the magic word, you know, so got to do something here. I just wanted to be prepared. Thanks.
Or more like Groucho Marx, right? Say the secret void.
That's right. That's right. But we'll be listening.
Yes. All right. Let's talk about Judge Posner. I just cannot believe what's been going on there. I've chalked it all up to Conan O'Brien hosting his show in Chicago all week and somehow making things go wacky there. Evan, why don't you bring us up to speed at first about the dismissal of the case that the judge entered preliminarily in the case concerning Apple and Motorola Mobility.
Well, I can address it in a perfunctory way and in very general here because, you know, after all, there's two patent lawyers in the conversation with us here today who can fill in the details and all the really good patent nuance. But this is the case where Apple sued Motorola, and it was here in the Northern District of Illinois. And Judge Posner, who is normally, or, you know, his paycheck comes from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in here in Chicago. He descended down to the district court level to try this case. And it was on June 6th or June 7th, he issued an order in a very Posnerian kind of style, but certainly deviating from the ordinary style that most district court judges use, entered this order that says, you know what? I'm inclined to dismiss this case with prejudice because I don't see how either side is going to say anything that's worth going to trial on over the question of damages for patent infringement here. So, you know, I think I'm going to dismiss this with prejudice. I'm not doing it in this order here today, but I'm going to think about it a little bit longer. And, you know, next week I'm going to issue a more comprehensive opinion because, you know, I might change my mind as I'm drafting that opinion. Well, a week comes and goes, or a week came and went, and, you know, Apple and Motorola both filed some stuff, you know, like you're want to see in patent litigation, just a bunch of papers because, you know, they very seldomly get to the issue here. But it was very close here because the trial was set to start this past Monday. And so we were literally on the eve of trial pretty much. And the judge says, I'm just going to toss this case. The trial is canceled. Well, it turns out now that Judge Posner has apparently changed his mind, and he's going to allow a hearing on June 20th for the parties to make arguments, for Apple to make its arguments as to why it's entitled to injunctive relief. So the final, or at least the bottom line for the present purposes here, is that the case is not being dismissed either with prejudice or without prejudice at this point. The Judge Posner has retracted at least his sentiment that was in that order from last week, saying that he can't see why this is something that should go to trial. So it's back on. And there, I think the real fun discussion that we could have here is, you know, why this happened, what's going through the judge's mind. But that's the summary of the status of that case where Apple's going after Motorola here in the Northern District of Illinois.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that an appellate judge would, first of all, be in this position of being able to make this call and then go ahead and say, you know, this trial is going to impose costs disproportionate to the harm and be contrary to the public interest. And I think it's just out of here. Matt, were you a little bit surprised by this? I'm sorry, not Matt. Steve.
Yeah, I mean, it is odd for judges to comment on cases like that. And I think it adds some problems, you know, going forward, you know, if whether or not one of the parties wants to look at disqualifying or whatever else. It was a strange comment.
Joe, I bet you you wished that the judge in Oracle versus Google might have had such a sentiment.
Well, then what would I have done for the last 6 weeks I spent in that courtroom? I had a fair amount of work because he chose to not do it that way.
That's true.
But yeah, I mean, one thing I would be curious in hearing about people's opinions about the Posner decision is, you know, he is letting them go forward in this limited way. But I wonder if between the strong words he had in that first order and also the recent blog post he posted, which is linked in that Giga link we have up, which mm-hmm. mentions a bunch of problems in American society, including a, quote, dysfunctional patent system.
Yeah, how depressing was that litany of things?
I still, you know, he kind of threw in the patent thing in a bigger list. But I sort of wonder if what we have here is at least the judge is making as harsh a comment as he can on what he sees as ultimately the triviality of some of the patents in these cases by saying that, you know, no, there may be infringement, but the fact is your damages case is so weak that if I were to calculate a royalty for your great inventions, I'm pretty sure I would come up with $0. Maybe a couple of the lawyers could tell me if I'm totally misinterpreting that, but I did see it as him saying something about both sides' cases being somewhat trivial in terms of the patents.
Well, what he said was he didn't think, you know, looking at whatever he's got in front of him at this juncture, that either side could show that they had been damaged. And then in his follow-up order, he said, okay, I'm going to give you a chance. You can brief this. I want briefs by next Monday. And so lawyers are going to be working through the weekend on both sides. And then we're going to have a hearing next Wednesday. See if you can prove to me that if either of you manages to show that your patents were infringed, that you've been harmed. And so that's the challenge they now face. Am I right about that, Evan?
Yeah, I think so. And first of all, Joe, I wanted to apologize for insulting you a while ago and saying that you were a patent lawyer. So
now I'm not. I am not a lawyer of any kind. I just play one on the internet.
Right. So, and Steve, all the kudos to you for being a patent lawyer. I'm losing out on this one. Anyway, you know what Judge Posner's order said is that, you know, they need to come to court next Wednesday and argue about the availability of injunctive relief because that's kind of separate and apart from money damages. I mean, it is one of the things you have to show if you're entitled to injunctive relief is that money damages wouldn't make you whole. So there has to be some other extraordinary equitable remedy here. I think nominally that's what the order is about, but I'm really trying to read some tea leaves here. Just knowing how Judge Posner is, I mean, he's very, he obviously feels enough at ease to be pretty renegade in the way that he's conducting this. There's a sentence that's right after the sentence that says show up to court on June 20th and make these arguments. It says the parties should be prepared to address the possibility of substitution for an injunction of an equitable decree for a reasonable royalty going forward. What he's saying in a fancy way there is, why don't you work on trying to settle this and come to court on Wednesday talking about what kind of royalty that could be paid here as a substitution for all this crazy litigation that's going on here. It makes me wonder, and I'm really going out on a limb, really being very speculative here. I have no real insight other than just what I'm grabbing from the ether to be saying this, is I wonder if Judge Posner had this in mind even last week when he issued that order that says, you know what, your arguments are silly. I'm inclined to dismiss this with prejudice. I'm canceling the trial. write a full order to give. I wonder if he was trying to get the parties to actually realize, oh, look, we were on the brink of trial here. What he's doing is knocking heads together there on the eve of trial. And I wonder if this is just still part of the execution of some strategy that he had to get this matter resolved in light of the fact that the claims and the defenses may be silly, to get some real resolution in a way that's actually going to make business sense rather than taking the resources of the judicial system with this patent system that he says is broken anyway. Just some speculation.
Steve, what do you think of Evan's theory?
Well, I can see that there's clearly a large amount of frustration on his part in this process, particularly where from his point of view, he's not seeing the damages that are there, but the parties are going after injunctive relief, completely shutting down the other side, blocking sales, blocking importation. And if there are no damages, then that's a pretty harsh, penalty in this case. But of course it's going to be the ones that the lawyers are going to go after, because it's going to be the ones that are going to be the most damaging to the other side and allow you to have additional sales while, that injunction is in place. So, I think it's clearly he's frustrated with the patent system, even in a post eBay world, allowing cases like this going, that are seeking that injunctive relief to go forward.
Well, Evan, is I really wish that someone would put up a fund to get Judge Posner some Cymbalta or something to, assist his world view, because he really seems to be on a downer right now. He wrote in his blog post that was mentioned in that GigaOM article that we have a huge public debt, dangerously neglected infrastructure, a greatly overextended system of criminal punishment, a seeming inability to come to grips with grave environmental problems such as global warming, a very costly but inadequate educational system, unsound immigration policies, an embarrassing obesity epidemic, an excessively costly healthcare system, a possible rise in structural unemployment, fiscal crises in state and local governments, a screwed up tax system, a dysfunctional patent system, and growing economic inequality that may soon create serious social tensions. So, if they're not already. So he forgot
to mention that there are 57 channels and nothing on, too. So that's the only other ill of society that I could think that he didn't mention. So, yeah, I mean, he needs some Cymbalta, but don't we all need some Cymbalta after hearing that list? Jesus.
I think so. Right. I mean, you really can't take issue with anything he's saying, but just to put it all together and dwell on it, I don't know if it's healthy. It's one of those things maybe, Evan, we could touch on when we do MCLE segments on substance abuse, as lawyers need to get educated about that, because it's a problem in the profession. So
yeah, it's funny you said that, because I was just thinking
evidence of it.
Yeah, after reading that, all I want to do is go drink. So there, there can be something really pragmatic.
Well, it's pretty interesting. He puts the patent system on a par with things like our overextended system of criminal punishment and very, terrible social ills. Steve, do you think that people are starting to equate the patent system with one of our big problems in United States society?
Well, I think it depends on who you're asking that to. Obviously from the people in the biotech and pharma world have a completely different opinion of it than, those newcomers, the software and IT world do. Mm-hmm. And so I think particularly within software, within, IT, the opinions, from the media that is based in that segment, as well as from the educational system, students coming out of colleges, they've been pre-programmed in this, mentality that that patents themselves are evil, when a lot of the problem they're having isn't in patents, it's with software patents in particular.
Right. And one of the things in that subsequent order that Judge Posner filed was he was warning Motorola to be prepared to address FRAND issues when they come in and try and talk about the harm that has been done to them. And that is something the FTC would also like Motorola, and also Motorola, I think, in two different cases, the Apple versus Motorola case and the Motorola versus Microsoft case. There are FRAND issues that the FTC doesn't like, too, in the ITC proceedings. Steve, what the FRAND? What is this? What's going on? Can you explain for us what fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory... well, I know that's what the acronym stands for, but can you please explain to us how it works and why it's an issue for Motorola in all these cases?
You know, I honestly don't know in this case how it applies. Mm-hmm. So.
You know, okay. I'd like to jump in real quick with something, if I could. Is my mic on? Hey. You know, I think that both orders of Judge Posner's have to be seen, you know, to really simplify what he's trying to do. What it looks to me is that he really wants to sharply limit the damages that are going to be available to both sides. I mean, his first order said you probably won't get damages at all. Then he backtracked a little bit in the second order, but he said you need to think about getting an ongoing royalty instead of an injunction. And Motorola, you've got FRAND issues, which means you might have legal limits on what you can charge for your patents. So we don't know what the exact outcome is going to be, but what I do see is two patent litigants going into a case where the judge is deeply skeptical about the value of their patents. And I think when you look at this in the overall context of the smartphone wars, this is bad for Apple because it's bad for the aggressor. Motorola's patents were thrown up as defensive patents after Apple went over to them for royalties. So, you know, it looks like we already had one case, Oracle Google, where that was sort of the first big battle of the smartphone wars that went to trial, and the IP owner lost badly. And I think we might have a second trial or hearing in the smartphone wars, which would be this Apple versus Moto case, in which, you know, neither side may come out ahead, and that ultimately, to me, makes Apple the loser.
It does seem like the courts are starting to get... and the FTC is starting to get concerned about the sort of willy-nilly flinging around of the patents. And I think it was in an interview that you did, Joe, that one of the lawyers for Google said that people were treating patents like lottery tickets. Do I have that right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, he makes a connection. You know, Google has, I think, over 100 pending patent cases against it right now. The overwhelming majority of them are troll cases, which is to say companies that have no business other than filing patent lawsuits and threatening patent lawsuits. Oracle, obviously not a troll case. But I said, you know, do you see a connection between those two types of patent attacks against Android? And he said the connection is that there's just a very big market for patents right now. Those were both troll patents and Oracle's patents were patents that were bought on the market. One was a big corporate purchase and one is bought in kind of a murkier troll market. But either way, that's the problematic situation we're in, which is if you want to file a lawsuit against a big company and try to strike rich that way, you certainly have the means to do so. And so that's bad news for Google because they don't see themselves having an offensive patent regime. And it's also bad news for Apple and Microsoft because they get hit by trolls, but it's a more mixed scenario because they also want to use their patents to kind of accomplish corporate goals and go after their competitors.
Well, Steve, can you explain to us how and what FRAND is and why it's coming up in these cases?
Well, you know, it has to do with, from a licensing standpoint, it even, you know, from looking at Posner's, how he was using it, let me back up a step. You know, we don't have, in the patent system, we don't have compulsory licensing. Mm-hmm. If you know, the patent gives you the exclusive right to make, use, and sell. And if you don't want to allow someone else to make, use, and sell, that's, you know, that's your prerogative. There is no way of forcing you to license that patent to somebody else. You know, like you might see sometimes in a copyright context. And so if Google has a patent that sits in the middle of the road and blocks all technology in a certain area and they don't want to give it to competitors, competitors are going to have to do something else. And luckily, there hasn't been, people talk about patents as a monopoly. There hasn't been these type of patents out there that are so strong, so important, that they just completely block any development whatsoever in a particular area, like you'd expect to see. People are constantly working around them in other areas. It's more of the question of applying those oddball patents back to them. France standpoint, I'm trying to think what how that works. I'd have to look it up for you, Denise. So I don't know if Joe or Evans knows.
Isn't it? Well, from what I've been gathering, I am no patent lawyer, but from what I've been gathering about people writing about this and the issues coming up, both from the FTC and from Judge Posner and elsewhere, if you have a patent that is a standard in the industry, a patent on a process that is a standard in the industry, that you can be compelled to, even though there's no compulsory licensing in the statute, it's a process by which you can be compelled to license. Am I getting that right, Joe?
I definitely don't have a full understanding of what all the details of FRAND are, but basically sharply, if you're following FRAND standards, then you are sharply limited in how much money you can ask for your patents. It's a pretty minimal amount. And sometimes, I've known of patent trials where I covered one patent trial where they had a FRAND trial outside of the jury. They would have a full day of jury trial, and then they would have a separate FRAND trial because the defendant had a separate argument where, even if we lose, we think you need to reduce the damages available to FRAND rates. And that was a legal question for the judge to decide. So that was a bench trial out of view of the jury. But there are different ways that those issues can get decided by judges. And Judge Posner clearly thinks that if Motorola's patent is successful, they're going to have to make some justification as to why the defendant, or excuse me, in this case, the plaintiff, shouldn't pay these really low FRAND rates. Can't give you a number, but I can just say they're going to be low if they have to obey the FRAND rules.
Okay, we have a couple of other little newsy developments this week on the patent front. The case against Samsung by Apple's efforts to block sales of the Galaxy S3 in the United States, which we had a funny segment on the show before about someone who did a very detailed analysis of how the Galaxy S3, one could say, had been designed to avoid Apple's asserted design patent issues. Of course, now, Samsung has expressly denied that, but Apple has lost that round. It looks like the S3 is going forward. Sales of it will in the United States. They did not succeed in getting a ban. And also of sort of newsy interest on the patent front this week, Google attempted to transfer some patents to HTC in its case with Apple, and that didn't work because Google didn't transfer enough of what HTC would have needed, the bundle of sticks it's referred to. They didn't get a big enough bundle of sticks. And Evan, do you think the lawyers for Right Haven might have drafted that transfer between Google and HTC?
Yeah, that's that one would be left to believe that. Matt McCary over at The Verge wrote a piece about this yesterday. And that's when I was reading his piece about that. That's what I thought. Wait, isn't this the problem that Right Haven had? The judges, I mean, this is obviously just by analogy because Right Haven is a copyright context and this is a patent context. But the problem is standing. When one party is going to transfer its ownership rights or its rights of some sort, a few sticks in that bundle to someone else, for that someone else to be able to assert a claim of infringement in that intellectual property, the agreement has to say the right things, and the appropriate sticks have to be effectively transferred. So that was the problem in the Right Haven case, where the judges more than one time said that the agreement by which Right Haven purportedly got the rights and the copyright to these newspaper articles that it was suing over wasn't effective to confer standing for there to actually be a case or controversy that, that Righthaven could stand and assert. Similar thing happened here. We don't know, apparently, we don't know what the agreements between HTC and Google said, but at least the ITC found that the agreements were not sufficient to give the right to seek relief on these patents. As Matt pointed out in the Verge piece, I mean, that they could go back and cross the T's and dot the I's that they didn't catch the first time, but I'm not familiar enough with the procedures of the ITC and how all that works and how that might prejudice the action that's already there. But it's not a a problem that can't ultimately be solved. It's just a little bit of a of an interesting little thing here that that underscores some problems with the transfer of technology and could play into the much larger dispute of whether and to what extent and how patents and other technology and other intellectual property should be transferred from party to party. It is, you know, fraught with a certain risk of non-transfer.
Yeah, I would just add to that. I do think some of the headlines, you know, saying that this was like a huge win for Apple and a huge setback for HTC were sort of overblown because, mm-hmm. to put it in perspective, you know, yes, those five patents were taken out. HTC has three other patents that were not taken away from them, I believe. I believe five out of eight got dismissed. And so, you know, it still is going to be one side with a few patents and another side with a few patents. Not necessarily in this case because you can't make a counterclaim in an ITC case, but in general, HTC still has patents, is still going to be able to go forward with something. And also, I think it's important. That's a non-public order, by the way. That all the coverage of that has been extrapolated from this one line that says, due to lack of standing. We do not know the judge's reasoning on this, as far as I think. So these analyses about rent a patent is dead and all these people handing out patents are it's not going to work anymore. I don't know if that's true. We don't really know the reasoning of that move.
Yeah, I mean, right, it could be anything.
Go ahead, Steve.
I mean, it could be anything from, you know, the license didn't give them enough rights or the license wasn't exclusive to, you know, even down to the standpoint of, you know, errors on the actual transfer to the wrong entity or something. It's, you know, it's hard to say if you don't have the additional information.
Right. And as far as the Galaxy S3 is concerned, it looks like the judge was most concerned with the timing of adding that case to the or that device to the already pending case against Samsung, that she didn't think that she could do that without getting a new hearing from the court and also without delaying the case that's already been going on. So it wasn't able to do that. Sounds like kind of a procedural problem that could be perhaps addressed if Apple initiated a new suit, but whatever, at this juncture, it doesn't look like sales of the phone are going to be blocked in the U.S., which is a good thing for people who've been anxiously awaiting that phone, which I understand is quite a nice one. Why don't you bring us up to speed, Joe, on the Eolus case, the final resolution of it, which you went out to Texas to cover? What happened there?
Sure. While I was out in Texas back in February, that case went to a really unbelievably short trial, considering it was nothing less than the future of the web at stake. It was only about a 4.5-day trial, and the defendants won a pretty overwhelming victory right out of the gate on their invalidity case. And a bunch of web pioneers came to testify, including Tim Berners-Lee testifying for the first time on the stand. It was really a fascinating case. Just watching the defense's case was a real pleasure to put on because you were like getting a crash course history lesson in the early days of how the web was put together and how the first pioneering browsers were made. And it was just fascinating. Now, if you know the other side had lost, there could have been some huge damage numbers, and it could have been a bigger story. although maybe he might have left a lot of people unhappy. Those patents had become notorious over the years. They had been thrown into a director re-exam, which is a rare move. They'd been denounced publicly by the W3C and Tim Berners-Lee. Despite all that, they were able to make it to the trial in East Texas. And the internet won. What's happening now is there was on Monday, a JMOL hearing. The plaintiffs are moving for a new trial, saying that the jury was sort of swayed by prejudice and passion, and that no rational jury could have come up with the conclusion that it did. But the truth is, those JMOL arguments get made by people who lose patent cases pretty routinely. And it's always has to be looked at as a long shot. So they probably will appeal it as well, and they might have a better shot there, but this recent motion practice is, I kind of look at it as a long shot by Aeolus. It's extraordinary that they're willing to try that hard. It's extraordinary that the University of California, their back, is willing to try that hard. And that's something I'm still looking into, actually. But unless Aeolus actually wins the JMOL, it won't be any surprises.
Right. Well, this is an example, isn't it, Steve, of the patent system sort of attempting to fix itself through the judicial process, because here the jury found that these patents that were asserted in the case were simply invalid, you know, so they're doing what people wish the USPTO would do more often, look at a patent and say, that's trash, it shouldn't exist. Do you think that people are breathing a big sigh of relief about the Aeolus case?
Well, you know, I think they are, from a standpoint of, you know, the prior art was able to get out there. They're able to apply the prior art and make a decision at that time as to whether or not that those patents should continue to exist. Mm-hmm. You know, software's always had this strange problem, which is for so many years and even today, you hold the source code secret. And so because of that, and because it took so long for patents on software to start happening, you have, you know, while somebody may have been doing that exact same thing 5, 10, 20 years ago, it's impossible for the patent office to be able to find that reference. And, you know, typically that is when you have the patent office issuing patents on something that the industry thinks, you know, is so plainly obvious. A lot of times that's the problem. There's just not the database out there that the patent office can search to find from a software standpoint, those references that when you take that, when you take that patent to trial, that you're going to find through doing extensive patent searching.
It seems like a circuitous route to take through East Texas to get to invalidate that trial or that patent, but that's the way our system is working these days. You said the jurors were a little bit surprised as well, Joe.
The jurors in the Aeolus case?
Yeah.
Well, no one really talked to jurors in the Aeolus case, mm-hmm. including me. I do know secondhand that they, I am told that they were sort of, did seem impressed by some of the, you know, more celebrity web pioneers like Tim Berners-Lee. I think they were impressed by the, you know, justifiably impressed by some of the luminaries that flew a long way to show up to what is a little town, you know.
Right.
Most people in Tyler and Marshall, another town that sees a lot of patent cases, do not know that until they get called one of those juries that they're area is such a hotspot for those kind of cases, and it surprises them, and it's interesting.
It is. I bet it does. All right, we're going to take a break now and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. We're here with Joe Mullen from Ars Technica and UC Berkeley, and with Steve Nipper and Evan Brown, and we're talking about patents and all kinds of good developments recently in technology law. And our sponsor that's letting us do all that is ShareFile from Citrix. You know, we've all got a problem today, especially in the legal world. Our days are filled with emails going back and forth, sending out legal briefs, contracts, and important materials. And increasingly, we need to send multiple attachments and much, much larger files. And what happens is your email client can't handle that. You get bounce backs and confidential information, unfortunately, being sent out without security in various ways. But there is a better way. That's using ShareFile like Citrix by Citrix, which I also use in my practice and is a great help. With ShareFile, you can send files of almost any size easily and securely. Instead of attachments, they're sent as a secure link. They're very easy to send, easy to receive, and they're tracked so you can see when your attachment is received and it's opened by the recipient. Plus, ShareFile allows you to access your own files from anywhere, from your laptop, your tablet, your smartphone, so you can get your work done wherever you are. And it really makes it easy to accomplish a task that has been dense and difficult in the legal field for some time. For me, it's my practice's personal extranet. You know, I haven't had to hire someone to set that up. You can personalize the page so that it matches all of your existing web presence, and your clients know that they are dealing with you in a secure and confidential way. They can upload things that they have on their end. So if they're trying to get documents for you to review, they can get them to you this way. And then in turn, when you have things that you need to share with clients or co-counsel to or opposing counsel, ShareFile is absolutely the great solution for you. It integrates tightly with Outlook so that you can just, again, click a little button, and instead of attaching a large file to your email, you're setting up a location on ShareFile where the file will reside, and you can very fine-grained control who can see it for how long and what they can do with the file once they've accessed it. So it's a really wonderful tool. We're going to get you started with a special offer for listeners of This Week in Law, a 30-day free trial plus double the usual storage you would get. So sign up today. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my promo code TWIL. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in my promo code TWIL, T-W-I-L. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, Joe, so among the various trials you've been mucking around with these days, of course, Oracle and Google, as you mentioned, was taking up a ton of your time. Do you want to sort of give us the post-trial debriefing there? What can we take away from that case?
Sure. At the end of that case, it came out as a pretty overwhelming victory for Google. It was a mixed copyright and patent case, and Google was the defendant, and Google was found not to have infringed the two patents that made it into the trial. Oracle's damage demands ranged as high as $6 billion at one point. The judge threw that out. They came back with another damage demand saying they wanted $1 to $2 billion. The judge threw that out. There was a third damages report that was put in. The judge didn't really accept that either. That was never made public. Instead, he hired his own independent damages expert, which is a pretty unusual step. In any case, at this point, they're not going to get any damages. They didn't win their patent case, and they won only a very tiny part of their copyright case, which is like a de minimis piece of code that was accidentally copied by someone, copied by its own author, someone who'd written it at Sun and then accidentally used it again in a context he should not have. And the judge, the most important one the judge made is that APIs are not really copyrightable at all. And in a very comprehensive ruling that went through sort of the history of the concept that Oracle was claiming, which is not copied code, because Oracle went to copyright war without any copied code. They instead made a claim about what's called an SSO claim on the structure, sequence, and organization of a code. So you can still make a copyright software claim if you believe someone covers the structure of your organized code, even if they don't copy your code verbatim. But in a pretty comprehensive ruling, Judge Alsup went through those types of SSO claims and found they've actually been rarely successful, that this strategy kind of peaked in the 80s at a time when judges were still kind of figuring out copyright and software. And he took a very skeptical view towards those kind of claims as a whole. So you had a judge that's, at the end of the day, it didn't really come out until that final order, looked very skeptically on the way Oracle used its IP, thought it was over-expansive and, you know, actually not legal. So Oracle has miles and miles of hills to climb before they could even get to a retrial, which is all they could get at this point. I mean...
well, of course, they can appeal.
Yeah, they can. And what I guess what I mean by miles of hills is that they can and they've said they will.
Right. So you're saying after the appeal.
They have to have two separate wins. They would have to win their case and say, Judge Alsup was wrong and APIs are copyrightable. Mm-hmm. You need to overrule them on that, number one. And then number two, if they got that result, then it's not like they would be able to collect from Google. Then they would get the right to go back to another jury trial and try to win because they didn't win this one. And in fact, we know from juror interviews post-trial, which a few members of the press got, there were that it wasn't close. The jury was split – the copyright jury was split 9-3 in Google's favor. At one point, it was 11-1 in Google's favor. The patent jury – same jury dealing with the different issues. The patent jury was split 11-1 in Google's favor. They did not look favorably on Oracle.
So despite all of that, it seems like perhaps Larry Ellison has been submitting himself to the persuasive powers of David Boies because he seems to have come away with a different impression about how everything went. And this is going to be pulled from your headline for your article, Joe, our CLE, our first CLE phrase for the show, and that's rose-colored glasses. Tell us about what Larry had to say at D.
Yeah, well, he didn't talk too much about Oracle Google, but he said, well, you know, he basically portrayed it as a win on copyright. He said they were found to have infringed, and there was a split on this fair use issue. But that headline was, I mean, that was a very kind of rose-colored glasses way of looking at it even at that time. And once the more information came out, it was within a week or 10 days of him saying that, it was revealed that it was just completely wrong because Oracle lost on the API issue, which is a critical issue for them. And that he also said that before these juror interviews came out. And the juror interviews revealed that it was a very pro-Google jury that did not approve of the way Oracle was using that IP that they acquired from Sun.
So, Steve, did you have any thoughts as you were watching along with the Oracle versus Google trial? Did anything about this trial strike you as remarkable?
You know, really, it was just the, you know, what we were just talking about with the comments he'd made about, you know, that Google had infringed. And, you know, if you take that logic that he'd used, every single fair use case we have, you can classify as, you know, there was infringement found. Obviously, when you move on from infringement into the fair use side of things to determine if that infringement is excused. And it was kind of funny to see him make that statement regarding infringement as if it was the end of the case. So interesting lawyering up in his language.
All right, let's move on to some social media related topics. Number one, I just wanted to highlight a study from Gartner, which is speculating, according to its data, that 60% of corporations are expected to watch workers' social media use for security breaches by 2015. So this will be our second catchphrase for MCLE purposes, and that is monitoring the monitors. Because I think, of course, if they are indeed right that 60% of companies are going to be snooping into their employees' social media activities, whether in a professional or official capacity for on behalf of the corporation or in their own right, you know, using social media in their off hours, then I think that we're going to see a burgeoning flock of products to try and combat that, whether there will be browser plugins or some sort of way of knowing when you're being watched. Otherwise, you know, people are just going to have to rely on themselves to exercise good judgment. And we know that that's not always possible or the ideal solution for folks. We have, let's see, there was one little tidbit in this story I wanted to pull out. Oh, yeah, the issue that comes up more and more as time goes on is that corporations are encouraging people to bring in their own devices and to use them in the workplace. And of course, if you're going to surveil those devices, you need to have the employees express consent. And I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. Evan, do you see this as a something that is coming to a head?
The only place where I see it really presenting issues that are all that interesting is in the BYOD context, bring your own device, because you've got an overlap of proprietary interests there. It's the personal property of the employee, but the employer, by its very nature, the very fact of allowing work-related communications and data to be stored and exchanged on that device, there's some weirdness and certain tension that's inevitably going to arise from how that is used when there's the employer's device, employee's device, and the employer's data and information. I don't see much of an issue with employers monitoring employees' use of social media, because it would seem that the both the technological and legal protections for the disclosure of social media information, it seems like those protections are already there in place and would serve the purpose of the employee's privacy in a way that doesn't really need to be affected. If I have my privacy settings so that, you know, my boss who's not a friend or a friend of a friend can't see it, well then, you know, what's the big issue there? The employer, unless there is this litigation going on, doesn't have any back channel way of getting into what's in the private social media space. So I don't really, I know that this is an issue that people like to talk about. I don't see it coming to a head or there to be anything really revolutionary or anything new. The disputes just seem to kind of go in a rather predictable fashion. You know, the NLRB, the line of decisions that it has come up with, the National Labor Relations Board, were saying that, you know, going and saying things about work, you know, on Facebook, that termination for that reason sometimes violates the law in as much as the law protects concerted activity. That seems to be a little bit novel or a little bit maybe unexpected. But otherwise, as far as privacy goes and employee interests and privacy, there's nothing uncontroversial, or there's nothing controversial unless it's with the BYOD device. And that's where policies and expectations really have to play a prominent role in all of this.
Yeah, I don't know if I 100% agree with you. I think.
Yeah, me neither. So go ahead.
Go ahead, Joe.
You first. That's fine.
I was just going to say, I think you may be right from the legal standpoint, Evan, that, you know, if you're using an employer's equipment and time and bandwidth, then legally, you know, they can do whatever they want with what happens with that equipment, time, and bandwidth, and monitor to their heart's content. But I do think that people's expectations and usages don't take that into account, and that can, I think, possibly lead to changes and legal carve outs. You know, we're starting to see a bit of that for when people reasonably expect that their communications will be private. What were you going to say, Jeff?
I covered privacy when I was at Paid Content a bit. I haven't looked at it too much in the last year, but, you know, I actually think a lot of this stuff in online privacy is pretty overblown. Like, at the end of the day, you know, they're tracking you, they're spying on you. But really, it's a lot of guys who want to sell you like a better mortgage and cat food, and it's really just advertising. I do think a lot of the fears are overblown. But I think the workplace is one place where the fears are not overblown. And I think about the people who have devices owned by their employer, and I think what the previous speaker was saying was that, you know, it may be legally quite clear that the employer is allowed to track, say, their BlackBerries that their workers use if their employer-owned BlackBerries, not BYOD. But I think that's actually a pretty serious privacy problem because I don't think, you know, I think employers may be, and I'm not a privacy lawyer, but I do think employers may be on pretty solid legal ground to do things like track their employees everywhere. And it's one thing if you're packing a FedEx truck while a guy's on the clock. It's another thing if you're tracking a smartphone and seeing what kind of bars he goes into, what kind of bookstores he goes into, who he has dinner with. So I do think there's potential for abusive employer tracking. And I think that's bad news. The growth of BYOD, actually, and the popularity of BYOD, bring your own device, where the employee owns the device, that actually has probably the most practical potential of freeing us from that sort of more Orwellian vision of having some bad employers out there that are doing too much tracking, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think that that's not going away. It's certainly been a trend on the upswing, especially in the down economy. It's nice to for companies to be able to offshore some of that expense, but is it worth it for them? Also on the privacy front, although this is, again, things that take place in public and the folks should know better, over at the Sunlight Foundation, they are maintaining an archive of deleted political tweets. So tweets from politicians who, for whatever reason, have thought the better of having that tweet out there and then deleted them. It's called PolitWoops, W-O-O-P-S, at politwoops.sunlightfoundation.com. And it's just an interesting way of, you know, Sunlight Foundation tries to shed light on the political system and have as much transparency as possible. So if things are getting deleted, they're wanting folks to be aware of that. Franklin, our intern, got in touch with them and asked if there's a mechanism in place for deleting deleted tweets from their site, should politicians wish to do that. And they got back to us and said that they hadn't actually heard directly from any politicians about the site at all, but that they would certainly, you know, consider any requests that came in, that it's possible they'll be moving to a process that involves manual review, et cetera. So, you know, there may be some relief for these folks if they just do something completely silly or a mistake. But if it's a substantive political issue, I have the feeling the Sunlight Foundation is going to let it stand out there for people to take a look at. We're going to move on to our resource and tip of the week. Our resource has to do with social media in the workplace, not so much in monitoring folks who are off the clock, but in the context of more and more businesses using social media officially to communicate with their customers and other constituents. And the fact that when you do this, you need to bear in mind that all of the record-keeping requirements that otherwise apply to your business continue to apply, although you may not be in charge of the servers in question, be they on Twitter or Facebook or what have you. So Michelle Sherman, who's been on our show before, has written a good article about this. It's called The Legal Four Corners of Social Media and E-Discovery for Business. And she basically sets out four pillars that she lays out as far as how businesses should think about keeping track of their social media communications so that they don't get in trouble down the road. So if you are a business and you use social media, I encourage you to check out Michelle's piece. And then for our tip is to tell you to go out and because we talk so much on the show about privacy policies and use policies that people don't understand and that may be 60 plus pages long, There's someone trying to do something about that. Joe Andrew, who's part of the VRM vendor relationship management list, has a project called Standard Label at standardlabel.org, and they have a survey. So our tip is to go and take that survey because it will definitely help. The idea is to put together a label much like food nutrition labels where you can just at a glance see if that thing in your hand is a heart attack or not. That is the idea they want to apply to online policies. And the survey, which is at standardlabel.org/survey.html, will help them gather information to, you know, as to, it's all anonymous and, you don't have to answer all the questions. They're all voluntary, but it will help them gather data to craft a label to put out there that hopefully will be adopted so that instead of having to wade through those 60 pages, you could look at one label and know in a glance whether this particular site is going to share your information with the world or not, and some other fine-grained details about it. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. We're thrilled to have had Joe Mullen join us. Joe, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
It was fun. And also thrilled to have had Steve Nipper back. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, thanks, Denise. Thanks, Evan.
Great seeing you. Enjoy Idaho.
Will do.
And Evan Brown back with us once again. So great that we're able to do this MCLE stuff. Folks, to be sure and check out that page on the wiki. Of course, Evan, we're going to have to not only do substance abuse, but bias in the workplace and ethics and all kinds of fun topics we could get into on future shows.
Oh, yeah. All that stuff that lawyers, you know, think they have all these hangups over. With all a great cornucopia of fun.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, guys, it's been wonderful fun. Before I go, I want to let you know that you can get in touch with us between the shows. You can email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can email Evan. He's Evan at twit.tv. And also check out our Google Plus and Facebook pages. Those are great ways to suggest stories that we can cover on the shows and to comment on the things that we already did cover and give us more detail and your thoughts about what we're up to. Also, you can tune in live with us when we record. We record every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC at twit.tv. And you can find the show in all the places that you most enjoy finding your web content. The main page is at twit.tv/twill. And also, you're going to find us on iTunes and YouTube and all those other good spots. And we really appreciate your joining us this week. And we can't wait to see you next week when we reconvene and talk more about the latest in technology law. Thanks so much, all. Take care.